Local author and world-renowned speaker Charlie Tremendous Jones said, "You'll be the same today as you'll be 5 years from now, except for two things, the people you meet and the books you read." The average person doesn't read a book a year. That must be why they're average. The Tremendous Life Books team invites you to find something that motivates you to be anything but average. Visit us today at our showroom on West Allen Street in Mechanicsburg or online at www.tremendouslifebooks.com.
Welcome to Conversations with Leaders on Tremendous Life Radio, providing some of today's most influential and inspiring leaders a platform to share their stories of growing up, what happened, and what they're doing today. Now, here's your host, Todd Weaver.
Welcome, everybody, to Tremendous Life Radio. Thank you so much for tuning in. It's a real honor and privilege, and I'm really excited about tonight's guest. We have Mr. Chuck Reeves. Chuck is a successful keynote speaker, a leadership, sales, and motivation expert, and an acclaimed author. His latest book, Journal of a Climber, is available now. Chuck, welcome to Tremendous Life Radio.
Todd, thank you for the invitation. So good to hear your voice.
It's not bad hearing yours either, Chuck. We're really excited having you, and we want to learn all about you and what you're doing today. And we really thank you for taking time out and joining us. So,
let's get if we could just pick up on that for a moment. There is a chemistry that happens when achievers interact with achievers. There's an energy that's sparked. We know that whenever two minds come together, a third mind is going to be created. And, you know, what Tremendous said is the books you read is the people that you get to know, and interacting with other winners, whether it's vicariously by listening to your program or one-on-one like you and I are having right now, it's going to make you grow. There's no way you cannot grow through an experience like this.
Hey, well, thanks for that. And that it's always refreshing to hear that. And I've been experiencing that now since we started the show. So you're definitely talking fact for me. And again, thank you. Let's get started. I want to learn about you. I want to learn about you.
Okey-dokey.
So let's talk about that. Take us back, if you would. And we always like to get the backstory on our guests. It never ceases to inspire and amaze me, you know, people's beginnings and how they see things. So what were your early years like growing up, and how'd you feel inside? What was going on?
Oh, interesting. I've lived in Atlanta or the Atlanta area all of my life. I was a post-World War II baby, and my dad came home from the war. He was wounded in World War II, and we went through all of that. He decided, or was called back into the ministry when I was about 6 years old, which meant he had to go back to college, and my mother had to go to work. And in those days, all moms were stay-at-home moms, so we were kind of an anomaly in the neighborhood. We also didn't have any money. So when people talk about growing up poor, well, I understand growing up without resources. You hear people say we were poor, but we didn't know it. Well, we were poor and we were aware of it. There were times when what was on our plate at dinner was not much to talk about. But, you know, when you have a family bond, when you have a family of ethics and integrity, you just put up with whatever life throws at you. So my dad became a preacher, and preachers don't make a whole lot of money. So my mom continued to work, and we went from church to church, and, you know, that was kind of the growing up part. When I was, I guess I was about 14 or 15, some people asked me to play with their band. I can play a little guitar. So I became a rock musician. But Todd, this was back when rock and roll was real rock and roll. Mm-hmm. Not the noise these children listen to today. We had some real music. You remember that, right?
Oh, absolutely. I'm from the same era.
That's right. And our lyrics, our words meant something, like Bapa Ho Mau Mau. That still rings true for us. So I'm playing in honky-tonks and bars on Saturday night, and my dad is preaching on Sunday morning, but there was nothing he could do about it because I made more money on a Saturday night than he made in a couple of weeks. And I was saving up to go to college because you go to college to get your education. So packed off to the University of Georgia with just enough money to make it through three quarters, and then came home to work summer quarter to make enough money to go back the following year, but I couldn't find a job. So I went back to school, slept in the back seat of my car, or my family's car, and went to class. And I had just figured out during those three or four quarters that I have a learning disability. I can't learn from books. So I tell people I can write books, I just can't read them. There are some books that I can get into and learn from them, but when it comes to a textbook or an analytic book, it just doesn't work with my brain for some reason. So I wasn't doing well in college, and I decided to go home and earn some more money and try to figure out what I was going to do with my life. Well, that's when the draft board checked to see if I was in school or not, and before I could turn around, I was in the Army. Those of us who were drafted in those days were kind of rebellious, I guess. And so we had this joke. What are they going to do, cut our hair and send us to Vietnam? Yeah. When I got off the boat in Vietnam, I realized they had done all they were ever going to be able to do to me. So there I was, 20 years old, on Hill 55 outside Da Nang. And because the lieutenants, the officers, were being taken out on a regular basis, we ran out of officers. To be a forward observer, you have to be an officer, but we didn't have any, so they made me a forward observer because I had been to map reading school. Now, I want you to imagine when you were 20 years old, a few months after leaving your teens, you have the authority to call in artillery, mortar fire, Huey gunships when they're available, and on two occasions, naval gunfire. So here I am doing all kinds of things, and in a combat situation, we change. And as a result of that, I did some things that I'm not especially proud of, but war is war, and I think Sherman had it right when he said war is hell. That changed things. So I came home from Vietnam, my head's on sideways, trying to find something that I can do. I got married immediately because I had proposed to a young lady before I left, and went to work for AT&T as a technician. The Army had trained me in electronics. AT&T needed some people to solder wires, so there I was. For 10 years, I got up every morning, put on my blue jeans, packed my lunch in a brown paper sack, and went down to 51 Ivy Street, downtown Atlanta, and I soldered wires for 8 hours a day. I would install equipment, adjust equipment, remove equipment, and then solder wires. All I ever did for 10 years was solder wires. Until one day, a gentleman called me in his office. And I can promise you right now, there's someone listening to us who is just like this gentleman. I've met many of them. He called me into his office and said, in effect, I see more in you than you see in yourself. I'm going to get you out of here. I thought, hot dog, I'm going to engineering. Because from operations, you go to engineering. In engineering, I would work a 35-hour week, not a 40-hour week. I would be drawing the circuits that I've been wiring for 10 years. I can do that in my sleep. Best of all, I would wear a necktie to work. Short sleeve shirt, pocket protector, and a necktie. The ladies will go crazy. Then he dropped the bomb. He said, engineering's full. I'm going to send you to sales. I said, well, actually, you can give me my tool belt back. I'm going to go upstairs and solder some more wires. I'm not going to sales. I can't talk to strangers. I can't speak in public. I don't even own a suit. All I knew about sales was Herb Tarlick, WKRP, plaid sport coat, loud mouth. That's not me. And then he did something interesting, Todd. He didn't know it was a sales technique, but it is. He locked eyes with me, leaned forward, and said, "I want you to try this for me. Because of my respect for that man, I stepped so far out of my comfort zone, I couldn't see my comfort zone anymore." So today, I encourage CEOs, executives, managers, supervisors, look your people in the eye and say, "I want you to try this for me." Stretch your people beyond their perceived limitations. All limitations are self-imposed. Self-imposed limitations is a redundant term. So what we're looking at is someone in your life, someone in my life, came along, raised the bar, and either demanded or encouraged us to jump over it. So I went to sales. Just because I liked this guy, I went to sales. My first full year as an account executive for AT&T, I was their highest producer out of 1,100 salespeople in our organization. And what was interesting about that, there were only three out of the 1,100 that didn't have a degree. Many of them had an MBA. So if I stop at that point in my story, we can look at it and say, let's see what the life lessons are. Whatever excuse you think you have, it's not an excuse. It is not valid. I don't have an education. It doesn't matter. I've never done that before. It doesn't matter. I don't know how to do that. It doesn't matter. I don't have the right appearance. I don't have the right skills. All of those things can be attained. There are coaches out there. There are mentors out there. And I'm not going to put you on the spot, Todd, but I know from what I've heard, there are people out there who needed a shot in the arm, a kick in the rear, or an encouraging word, and you happen to cross their path. And you're the one that stopped for a moment and said, okay, let's look at it this way. And as a result of that, they are now successful, and they're mentoring other people as well. When I got drafted, I had some self-imposed limitations. One of my self-imposed limitations was I could not get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, run a mile before breakfast, sing, and enjoy it. But there was this 280-pound drill instructor who convinced me I could get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, run a mile before breakfast, sing, and enjoy it. I didn't like that guy. But when I got to Vietnam, I appreciated everything the man had taught me. As we go through our lives like this, we wind up teaching lessons. Sometimes we're aware of it, sometimes we're not. There are times when we know we are helping somebody else, they've crossed our path for a reason. And then there are other times when people will come back and say, "Todd, you know, the other day when you said thus and so," and you're thinking, they've got me confused with somebody else. I never said that. Yes, you did. It was an aside remark. It was something that you said just off the top of your head, or you felt the urge to say it at the moment, and then you promptly forgot it. But that was a seed that you planted in their life. The other piece of this is we are all planting seeds. So are we planting fruit trees? Are we planting vegetables for nourishment? Or are we planting weeds? Everyone that I encountered today was a very long day. I woke up at 3 o'clock West Coast time and jumped on an airplane from Sacramento to Salt Lake City, then from Salt Lake City to Atlanta, and then went through some hassles in Atlanta, went back to the office, and engaged a lot of different people. And every person that crossed my path was an opportunity. Either I could encourage them, or I could have my way and have them try to do what I want them to do. Those of us who travel a lot, we learn the rules of the road. We learn what it means to have etiquette on airplanes and etiquette in airports. But if we start demanding our rights, or our perceived rights, we miss out on these opportunities to to help and serve other people. There was a screaming baby on the airplane. And as we were getting on the plane, here's this child throwing a tantrum. And several people were saying, well, I hope he doesn't sit next to me. I hope that's further back. I hope the kid goes to sleep. And when I got up next to the parents, I said, is there anything I can do to help? You know, there's two options here. Every time we face an encounter, there's two options. So AT&T makes me their top salesperson. Packed me off to Acapulco. I had to get a passport, never had a passport before, never been out of the country except to go to Vietnam. So I got a passport, went down to Acapulco, got off the airplane. They said, anything you want to do, sign your name, and it's done. I went parasailing. Parasailing means you put on the rig, they roll the rope out, roll the rope back in, takes about 10 minutes, that's $60. I parasailed all the way around Acapulco Bay. It was fabulous. I was up for an hour and a half. Got off, signed my name. I thought, this is great. This is great. Came back to Atlanta. They applied the Peter principle and made me a sales manager. You know, in large corporations, if you do good at one level, they move you up to the next level. Do good there, they move you up to the next level. So they were trying to find my plateau of incompetence. So they made me a sales manager. If you take your best salesperson and make them a sales manager, typically you get two things, less sales and bad management. Well, I knew how to sell, so they didn't lose any sales. I still carried a bag, but I didn't know a thing about managing. So my Friday, I was a salesperson. Monday, I'm a sales manager. I don't know anything. So I'm sitting at my desk. I'm trying to figure out, what am I supposed to be doing here? And I started watching all of the other sales managers. I can't learn from books, but I can learn from observation. So I watched all the other sales managers. Whatever they did, I was going to do. So I started calling a series of pretty much useless meetings, because as far as I could tell, that's about all a sales manager did. You take productive selling time and put people in a conference room. I didn't know what an agenda was, so I stood up and said, what questions do you have? I'm your new boss. What questions do you have? They all had the same question. You were top salesperson last year. I want to be top salesperson this year. How did you do it? Here is one of the most important life lessons anyone is ever going to learn. Your most valuable contribution to the world is probably something that you take for granted. Your most valuable contribution to the world is probably something that you think, well, everybody knows that. Anybody can do that. So they said, how did you become top salesperson? I didn't have a clue. So I thought for a minute and I said, well, do what they taught us in sales school. They said, we're doing that. You're doing something different. What is it? I said, well, learn the products. They said, we know the products. You're doing something different. What is it? We talked about it for 2 hours. Guess what it was? I never gave up. To tell you, that comes from a place of nobility and character or something. Think about it for a moment. The 10 years before I went to sales, I was in an entry-level operations job. When you're in an entry-level job and somebody tells you to do something, what do? You do it. They say jump, on the way up, you say how high. Prior to that, I was in the Army for 2 years. In the Army, when they tell you to do something, what do? You do it. So I had 12 years of conditioned behavior. I went over to the sales department. My boss said, go sell this stuff to those people. What did I think I was supposed to do? Sell this stuff to those people. We had the highest price, oldest technology, and slowest delivery. Other than that, we were pretty darn competitive, but we had those three elements working against us. My customer would throw me out of my ear. I thought, I got to sell this stuff. I would rework my proposal, take a different approach, and go back and try again. I don't know if they felt sorry for me, if they got tired of listening to me, but enough of them bought from me that I got to be top salesperson. What drives people to achieve? What drives people to succeed? And what I tell CEOs now and senior executives, you got to look under the layer, the top layer here. There's something else motivating everyone in your organization. You need to figure out what it is. A sales incentive and compensation plan. Sometimes it has to be a one size fits all, but if there's any way to have bonus money, arbitrary money, subjective rewards, use those to motivate people at their sweet spot. For me, it was my daughter. My daughter got here with a birth defect, and after AT&T's insurance had paid about all it was going to pay, I still had thousands of dollars of debt. I understood that if I got in the top 10% of the sales team, I would go into bonus money. And with that bonus money, I could start paying down some of that debt. So that was my hidden reason. That was what was behind my drive to go and be as successful as possible. So we don't paint everybody with the same brush. That's part of what the book is about. We don't look at everyone the same. We start looking at what is their drive. Well, the AT&T job stopped being fun. If it's not fun, don't do it. Deregulation, divestiture, some other things were coming along. My job turned into a position of putting numbers in boxes. I don't do that very well. So I quit. What had happened was, once a quarter, all of us salespeople had to meet at the Cave of the Winds, our corporate headquarters, and people who had something significant that they had achieved would stand in the pit. It's kind of an amphitheater thing. So I had the sale of the quarter, so I just had some fun with it. Built a PowerPoint and just kind of joked around with it. That night, we had a professional speaker come in after dinner. And after dinner, some people who didn't even like me came up and said, "You did a better job this afternoon than this guy did." So I went to my boss and I said, "What are we paying them?" Highest producer, they're paying them for 90 minutes what they're paying me for 2 weeks. Money is the wrong reason to do anything. However, I learned at that point you could stand up and talk and actually make a living. See, my dad had been a minister. Sometimes he got paid in chickens. I remember when he was making $1,200 a year. We were poor. We're using secondhand clothes and stuff like that. Now I realize I can do the same thing he used to do, except now people will pay handsomely for it. So I wrote a book on motivation called The Theory of 21. The Theory of 21 says for every person who will say yes, there are 20 who will say no. For a positive response, you got to find the 21st person. Stay in sales about a week. You'll figure that out. I sent my proposal to 21 publishers because 20 out of 21 are going to say no. They were all New York publishing houses. I mailed them on a Wednesday, went to the post office, dropped them off, said a prayer, went home, and I had learned that I would have to wait 6 weeks to 8 months to get the rejection letters. On Friday, that was Wednesday, on Friday, an editor called and said, "Is the book still available?" I said, "Well, yes." She said, "Don't do anything until I call you back on Monday. The other editors are going to look at it." Monday, they called me back, and we had a deal. I sold a book in 6 days. I was in New York the following Wednesday signing the contract. What do you think started coming in the mail after that? 20 rejection letters. So for 10 years, all I did was motivational talks, and I would read those some of those rejection letters to the audience. Now, what was the point of that? It doesn't matter what your dream is. It doesn't matter what your objective is. It doesn't matter what you know you are capable of doing. You'll find a lot of people who will tell you you cannot, should not, and will not. And their motivation, their underlying theme is jealousy. If you say you're going to succeed, they're going to try to hold you back because they will see your success as their failure. Is that bizarre or what? You and I don't see it that way. Successful people don't see it that way. Winners don't see it that way. every time I was with Tremendous, he was always talking about other people and how they were succeeding, other people and their principles of success, other people and what he had learned from them. You see, there's no shortage of success. There's only a shortage of people willing to go after it. There are a lot more people who want to be successful than there are people who are willing to become. So we look at this and say, okay, I want to become successful. We have to drop the word be and change it to the word become. How do we do that? Now we go back to what Tremendous tried to teach us. The books you read, the people you meet. Every answer we need is out there. If you go to Tremendous Life Bookstore, if you just stand there and read nothing but the book titles, you'll come away inspired. We need the depth. We need to know how to set and attain goals. We need to know how to interact with other people. We need to know how to make it worth someone else's while to help us. And most importantly, we need to be willing to go out and help other people. So I did the motivational talks for a while until a client said, if you were AT&T's top salesperson, why don't you come train my salespeople? That's the dumbest thing I ever heard in my life. Because I figured if I could do it, anybody could do it. And now we're back to that principle. Your greatest contribution to the world is going to be something that you take for granted. So over the past couple of decades, I've been developing some pretty advanced now sales processes like Kaizen for sales, supply chain selling, real sales automation. I do speaking, training, consulting, and software. I have some sales automation stuff. And just having a ball, I think I enjoy what I'm doing almost as much as you enjoy what you're doing.
Chuck, it's, you know, I'm sitting there listening to you and I'm just kind of awestruck. You know, you said so much and I have questions, and then you just kept giving me more value and those questions went away. So, you know, I mean,
yeah, us runaway speakers can do that, you know.
No, but it's been so far. I mean, what a joy. You know, I want to, if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions because it's making me crazy, you know, like, and thank you so far. Thank you so much. When you were growing up, I want to take you back there just for a moment, because something must have been going on inside of you that I don't know if you knew it at the time, but I'm hoping you've identified it since then, is there was some sort of drive inside of you to do something. You might have just been floating around, but what was going on? Like, you wanted to go to college because that you knew you needed to. Was that imprinted on you, or did you just kind of know that?
Okay, well, let's think about that. That was actually imprinted. I like your word, imprinted. This was societal norms. You'll never amount to anything unless you go to college. When I came home from Vietnam, I had saved my combat pay and had just gotten married. When I was on R&R, I went to Tokyo. They had this special program if you were in the Army or in the military. And I bought a brand new Buick. I had never had a car in my life. So my first car is a Buick, for Pete's sake, Buick Coupe, teal mist blue, black vinyl top, gorgeous automobile. And I gave my wife this beautiful coat with a fur collar. And we went to church, and we were coming out of church one Sunday morning, and a friend of my father, who was also a minister, said, you got to get back in school. You'll never amount to anything unless you go to college. He put his wife's coat on her, and there was a hole in the back of it. It was a wool coat. It was like a moth had eaten it. He went over and got into this old station wagon with broken windows. I thought, societal norms are not for me. Now, I was suffering from PTSD, which did not really emerge until about 5 years ago. There were things, there were these undercurrents, and now I'm trying to figure out, who am I and what am I supposed to do and to amount to here? Well, fast forward, I had a Bronze Star given to me in Vietnam. I didn't really appreciate that. When I was a teenager, we had folk music festivals. I would walk out on stage, do nothing but walk out on stage and get an ovation. And that meant nothing to me. So when you say there must have been something going on, well, there was, but I was totally unaware of it. Totally. So fast forward, 12 years later, I'm AT&T's top salesperson. And people are asking me, how did you do it? And as part of looking at all of that, I recalled a phone call that I had gotten a few weeks before they announced I was the top salesperson. It was a phone call from an account executive in Birmingham, Alabama. And the sole purpose of her call was to tell me that people with college educations had more on the ball than people that didn't. That was a pivotal moment because it didn't make an imprint. All of these things that have been imprinted on me, you must do this, you have to obey these rules, that's when I realized the imprint was gone. One of the reasons I think I could sell is when I sat down in front of, they gave me the worst customers they had. They gave me a client one time who had two lawsuits against AT&T. I went in for my whooping because that's what he needed to whoop up on somebody. Yeah. And I went in with the attitude, he's not going to be shooting at me. On Hill 55, they were shooting at me. But this, I will at least come out alive. I'm going to have my self-esteem kind of raked over the coals. But so what's going on? Let's look at that for a moment. As a parent, what did I instill in my children based on my experience? As a parent, what did you instill not only in the kids that you could influence, but the children of the people you were influencing? We have to look at that and say, we're planting seeds up and down the chain. We're planting seeds. My marriage did not last, but I have this incredible wife now and much better than I deserved. And I remember one night sitting on the deck when our daughter was a teenager and she had some of her friends over. I could not find anything to like about those friends. Part of that is protecting my daughter, of course, but I didn't like the guys or whatever. And my wife started engaging them. And as she engaged them, they physically, mentally, and spiritually changed right in front of us. Kind of a metamorphosis. The facades went away. The anger went away. And we started seeing that behind that imprint that was on them, the language they were using, the clothes they were wearing, the tattoos, the piercings, and all that. Behind all of that, there was someone crying out for somebody to help them succeed. It's just, it's amazing to me.
Well, take us right there, what you just said, Chuck, please. You were at that point when you were with those teenagers on your deck, you already had learned some things, or you became aware of some things in yourself and the world. So you were paying attention to that when you saw that. I mean, that might have all happened and you didn't notice any of it. So what did you do next? And when you realized you were aware that you have an opportunity here to be of value to these teens.
Yeah, once we figure it out, I'm a slow learner, by the way. Once we figure it out, then we have to decide, do we offer to help? Mm-hmm. I have all too often offered to help when I should not have. People will ask for help. Oh, sure, sure. And now I'm so blooming busy, I don't have time to turn around. I don't have enough time for the family. So I'm having to learn to say no. Part of our role as role models, as leaders, as achievers, as people who are seen as being successful by other people, we have to learn when we're the right person to be their coach or teacher and when we're not. And that's difficult for me because I knew growing up, anybody who would give me any kind of help, I was all over it. So now I kind of want to pay them back. But what changed for them? One of those kids I wound up mentoring until he packed off to college. The rest of them, I can't really recall what happened, except my wife would often be sitting alone with them, off in a corner somewhere, and they would be nodding. So I think she had a greater impact on them than I did.
Thank you so far, Chuck. I wanted, you know, and it's been such a joy so far and a lot of value, at least for me. So I wanted to talk about the book. And, you know, in the book, you talk about the different mounts, seven of them to my count. But one of the questions I have for you specifically, because it is a free flow show and I don't have a lot of questions. One is, it's interesting to me that after Mount Significance is Mount Wisdom. That just seems, that's interesting to me. You know, take us through some of the book, please, and those mounts, and help me understand why Wisdom is after Significance.
Oh, you know, that is one of my favorite questions, by the way. There is a lot of use right now of the phrase moving from success to significance. Mm-hmm. We look at our lives and we say, I wish I had known then what I know now. Well, that's regret. I don't get into that. Actually, I do, but I have to pull myself back out of it. We look at our growth. When you and I first started making our way in the world, other people told us what success was. You're successful if and when. You live in this neighborhood, you drive this car, you have this kind of income, you eat in these restaurants or whatever. And it takes us a while, people like me, it took a lot longer, to figure out, no, everyone's definition of success is different. So we move from success to significance. What is significant for you? My dad, as I said, was a minister. His pension from the Methodist Church would be based on his salary for the last X number of years that he was preaching. Well, the last 3 years, he took a step down. So he took a cut in pay. And I went to him and I said, that's not success. He said, you don't understand. Success for me is spending more time with your mother. And he was dead right. Because shortly after he retired, he had some physical issues and there was no more time to spend with his wife, the woman that he loved. So we look at that and say, okay, now I've redefined success, but bigger barns and faster horses don't make a legacy. So we look at significance. The number of people at our funeral will largely be determined by the weather. So what are we going to leave behind? We want something of significance. When we go to the Speakers Association, we can talk to the younger speakers, and all they talk about is number of engagements, size of the audience, what their fees are going up. We can't talk about the actual number, but their fees are going up. And for a while, that's where I was, but that's not significant. What's significant for me after I speak is someone coming up after my program and saying, you made me think. Okay, that's significant. That's a seed. Then I realized we move from significant into wisdom. Wisdom can only come through education and experience. Wisdom is the result of education and experience. What have we learned and what have we lived through? So I believe everybody has a pair of lenses, whatever the word is. One lens is education, one lens is experience. Education is everything that you have learned formally and informally. It's every course you took when you were in school. It's the article that you read this morning. Experience is any event in your life that impacts the way that you think. Do you know anyone else who has the same pair of lens that you do? Nor do I. There's nobody on the planet like you. So we look at that and say, we bring a color of wisdom, a shape of wisdom, a style of wisdom that nobody else has. So now when we get together and start networking, we don't talk about success. We don't talk about significance. We start talking about wisdom. What have we learned? What's life really all about? Harry Chapin is best known for writing the song, The Cat's in the Cradle. Mm-hmm. I believe when your work on earth is done, you get to go home. So if you're still here, you're not done. You and I are still here. We're not done. Shortly after writing Cats in the Cradle and just doing just fine with that, he and Tom Key wrote a musical. The musical is called Cotton Patch Gospel. And the premise was Jesus was born in the 1950s in Gainesville, Georgia. So it just takes the whole gospel story and puts it in a different context. It's humorous, it's fun, but it's very poignant. And at the very end of the musical, there's a song, and the opening line is, "This is a song that needs no explanation. This is a song that only time could bring. This is a song I call my jubilation, and all I've got to do is sing." Rosita Perez was one of my favorite speakers, bless her heart, and a motivational speaker, played some guitar and stuff. And her whole theme was, most people go to their grave with their music still in them. Well, I believe our wisdom is our music. That's what we leave behind. Have you ever heard a song and it brought back memories? Have you ever heard a song and just could not get it out of your head? We're learning now how this 3-pound thing in our cranial cavity works. We called it the brain or the mind. And we're finding now that certain areas of our brain are stimulated by music and nothing else. There's just something about music. It's both the rhythm and the tempo, the rhythm and tempo, and the structure of the music. There are frequencies, by the way, that will excite the nitric oxide, not nitrous oxide, which is sleeping gas, the nitric oxide in the blood and create euphoria. So we can be listening to a piece of music we don't even like, and yet we still feel good about it. So as we learn about how we are influencing other people, our choice of words, intonation, the voice, there is a lot we can do. And wisdom brings to the table at the moment what we need to say and how we need to say it. I wish we could grow, we could be born wise, but wisdom only comes from education, and it's a lifetime of education and a lifetime of experience.
Well, and Chuck, thank you for that. And I wanted to mention, because I kind of failed to, that all the listeners, they can learn all about you at chuckreeves.com, and that's Reeves, R-E-A-V-E-S. Is that correct?
Yep. That's correct. The R double E's are Baptist and Moonshiner, so we changed the way we spell our name. It's Chuck, R-E-A-V-E-S. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I want to talk also about the Mount Beyond Mount Wisdom in the book, in the journal, Servanthood, and that got my attention. Talk to me about that, please.
Yeah, let's talk about that. When we get to servanthood, when we start looking at serving others rather than having others serve us entirely, it comes home, I think, when we give somebody something that we think has little value and they treasure it. When we have the opportunity to give somebody, maybe it's words, maybe it's an amount of money, maybe it's an opportunity or an introduction, and they just go ape over it. What happens inside of us? Well, to me, that's the whole servanthood aspect of us that each of us was designed to be. At some point, you look at a professional athlete. They start playing when they're a kid, and they train through high school. Then they play college. Some of them only play 1 or 2 years now, and they go to the pros. But then there's that day of reckoning. They can't play anymore. They move into, I believe, wisdom and then servanthood. The neighborhood that I live in has a number of the Atlanta Falcons living in the neighborhood, and they fall into two categories. The ones that think the world owes them a living, they're the greatest thing since canned peaches. And, you know, if I had their lifestyle, I probably would too. Then there are these others that are so genuine, so real, so willing to give. and they'll see a kid out in the yard throwing a football. They'll pull their car over, go over and give the kid some pointers. Servanthood, willing to give, willing to share. I had this experience one night. I'll never forget it. I flew into the Atlanta airport. It was about 10 o'clock at night. There was not much going on after 10 o'clock. And at that time, there was this skycap who worked in the mornings, and he carried Bible tracts in his, he wasn't flagrant, you know, he wasn't a preacher or anything like that, but if he saw someone in need or someone in distress, he would go over and encourage him. He might encourage him with a few words, with one of his tracts, or even with a few dollars. So he worked in the mornings, and sometimes I would see him. Well, I came in 10 o'clock at night, and I had this unction to give that man a certain denomination of bill of money that I happened to have in my pocket. And I thought, well, I'm safe because he works days. He's not going to be here 10 o'clock at night. So I'm merrily heading my way out of the airport. Well, guess what? There he is. I came around the corner. He was standing with his foot in a chair with his back to me, and he was talking to a homeless man. They were just talking. I couldn't hear them, so I don't know what they were talking about. I thought, okay, I got to go give him this money. So I walked over, held the money out. Without looking at me, he reached over, took the bill, handed it to the man, and said, well, here it is. They had been talking about that man's need, about what that man needed. So I looked at that and thought, I'm being a servant. The skycap is being a servant. We have this opportunity on a regular and ongoing basis. The Atlanta airport is kind of my second home because I'm there so much. It's a confusing airport. People get lost easily. So like tonight, I helped some people. When I flew out on Tuesday, I helped some people find their gate and whatever. Well, these two ladies showed up one day, and they were wearing a lot of bling, and they were very flamboyant. And from the way they were talking, I had a hunch they weren't very well educated. And they were as lost as a golf ball in a snowstorm. I said, could I help you ladies find your gate? And I explained to them how to find their gate. And one turned to the other and said, see, I told you Jesus would help us out. Well, here I am being a servant. I'm not even getting credit for it, for Pete's sake. But opportunities to serve are everywhere. And the more we serve, the more we enjoy serving, the less internally focused we become, and therefore the more valuable we become to others, and therefore, I believe, the society.
Well, isn't it true then, Chuck, the book, Journal of a Climber, and taking us through that trek, it is the trek of life, and it is an inside job, right?
You know, it really is. And for the people who aren't familiar with the book, between each mountaintop, there's a valley. And we have to go through those valleys in order to prepare ourselves for the mountaintop experience. Some people will hit a valley, turn around, and go back. Mm-hmm. Some people will see the challenge of the valley and decide to stay right where they are. The first mountain in the book, first mount, is Mount Majority. Well, that's where the majority of people are. And you know what? The majority of people right now are watching some inane TV program. They're not listening to Tremendous Life Radio. They're not reading the books that will take them to the next level. They may be reading a gossip magazine. They may be looking at something that a week from now will have absolutely no relevance at all. I was scanning the headlines today as I was getting off the airplane. Has anything happened while I was on the airplane? And there was this headline about, who are the front runners in the Republican presidential race? Who cares? Because tomorrow it'll be different. Next week it'll be forgotten, for Pete's sake. Are we focusing on the enduring things? And when that valley comes along, we're going to hit challenges. I don't know any successful person who went straight to the top. It's not a smooth, easy trip. And I believe it's incumbent on people like you to share the valleys, the time you fell flat on your face, those opportunities you had to quit, and you didn't take it. When people ask me, how'd you get to be successful? I had the opportunity to quit and I didn't take it. How did you earn a Bronze Star in Vietnam? I had the opportunity to quit and I didn't take it. That is the only difference in successful and unsuccessful people. You're going to hit the snag. You just got to be willing to pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and go and try again. Am I preaching too much?
No, not a bit, man. I'm loving it. It's earlier in the hour, you had mentioned it. You just kind of inferred it again or made me think of it again is, Chuck, what do you think was the main, if you could even pinpoint, the one main driving factor that has kept you from not quitting, even from very early on? Because you mentioned earlier in the show, too, never giving up. Ooh. Where did that come from?
You just stepped into a study that I'm doing right now. There's different parts of the brain. My wife is a counselor. I do consulting. We look at the same mind studies. She looks at it from an interpersonal skills relationship. I look at it, obviously, from a business point of view. And we're learning about how the different areas of the brain work and then how they are stimulated and how they are neutralized. Well, there's the amygdala, which is the fight or flight part of our brain. Fight or flight. So when you hit a conflict, how do you react? And it took me, I guess, 10 or 15 years after I got home from Vietnam to realize I'm a flight first, fight second individual. There were people in combat, if you run, you're a coward. If you just react or respond too quickly, you're dead. And so what I've learned is when I hit that obstacle, back off for a second, try to put it in some kind of realistic perspective, and then start moving forward. And I think the Vietnam experience is what actually brought me forward, brought me out of that, because I had to save myself and other people. And I looked at it and said, wow, we did that. And then when I modified some equipment while I was a technician and they awarded patents on it, I thought, wow, I did that. And to modify the equipment, I would try this, it wouldn't work. Try that. I felt like Thomas Edison sometimes. You build a whole bunch of them, they don't work. And then in sales, you go back and you try. So over time, I have just learned no doesn't necessarily mean no. No might mean not now, but no probably means you didn't get it right that time. Try again. Did anyone ever learn to ride a bicycle without falling and skinning their knees? And it's that picking ourselves back up, going back and trying again. And yeah, we lick our wounds and say, I'm not going to do that anymore. Then we go back and we try again. I hope that answers the question.
Well, absolutely, Chuck. And I can't help but reflecting on my own wisdom, I guess it is, my own, experiences. And, I've fallen down many, many times and I've gotten back up. And maybe that is my core value, is that not quitting. But there are times, am I correct, where we may need to go down a different path. We may need to quit. Certainly what comes to mind is if I'm a drug addict or an alcoholic, I need to quit. But, in other ways, even in business ventures, when we see maybe. So for me, the value of having, like Charlie said, the people we surround ourselves with or allow us to be surrounded by, where people can give me some input and mentor me along like that.
You want to surround yourself with people of wisdom. What's wisdom? Education and experience. Mm-hmm. We start going down a road. There is somebody who's already been down that road. Don't think you're blazing a new trail because you're not. Or someone has been down a similar road. And I need someone to come alongside and say, okay, here is what you're going to encounter. They don't say you can do it. They don't say you can't do it. They just say, here is what you're going to encounter. Then if they're a wise individual, that's all they will say, unless we ask, how would you suggest I handle that? If you were facing that, what would you do? or how did you face that? And we start learning from their education and their experience. Let's don't reinvent the wheel. I woke up this morning with a new chuckism. I actually had to pull my phone out and email it to myself so I wouldn't forget it. I've been telling people, you know, what brought us here is not going to take us forward. If I always do what I've always done, I will have less than I've ever had before. The competition's changing. Technology is changing. The world is changing. Our customers are changing. We can't keep on doing the same old thing. And what hit me yesterday morning was the road that brought me here can only take me back where I started. It's a two-way street. So I've got to find another path. I've got to find something else. And you're absolutely right. There are times when we need to say, that isn't going to work. I've had scores of people come to me and say, I got this great idea. I want you to work with me so we can take it to market and we'll make $1 million or whatever. It's the dumbest idea in the history of time. And you can't tell them that, but you can teach them that. And we teach with questions. Oh, okay, well, let's look at this. So what will your manufacturing costs be? What will your customer acquisition costs be? And where will you manufacture this and how will you take it to market? After we go through all of that, so what's your embedded cost going to be by the time a consumer can put their hands on it? Okay, and you want to mark it up 100%. Is anybody going to pay that kind of money for that type of device? I have people come to me all the time. I got this great idea. There's 1 billion people in China, and none of them have one of these. You know how many you can sell in China? One. One person will buy it, reverse engineer it, and they'll start making it over there. If you want to sue them, good luck with that. So we need people of wisdom, people who've got their education, got their scars, like you. You've fallen down, you've gotten back up again. They've got their education, they've got their wisdom.
Well, and Chuck, thanks for that. My driving factor, I believe today, from what I've understood about myself or understand so far, is that from all those what seem to be mistakes or failures or valleys, I don't want to let any of those things go to waste. You know, I want to make sure that there's some value in all that. You know, so I guess there is a form of servanthood. You know, I can share even what we do here in this show by bringing you the opportunity to share your wisdom and your experience. That's, I believe, the real power of storytelling is, because I don't know how anybody else is going to hear it. I don't even know who's going to hear it. And I don't know how it's going to impact their life. So that is kind of out of my hand. So my purpose here is to facilitate the story being told, let's say, and my own story. You know, I tell my story all over the place, you know, and I love telling my story. Mainly because one of the reasons is because I love talking about me, like we were joking about before the show, but also because there may be some value there, you know, and not everybody has to fall down the same holes that I did. They may, but they don't have to if I share my experience.
There we go. I tell you, Todd, the most exciting part about your life to me is the fact that your roots run deep and far. And you don't have a clue where they went. Once you put this program on air, you don't know who hears it. You don't know what they heard. You know, what people hear and what we say is two different things, because they're hearing through their lens. Mm-hmm. So you have no idea how far you've gone, how many people you've touched, but you do know that there's growth out there. Jesus healed 10 lepers. A leper was an outcast from society. How many came back and said, thanks? One. So we don't change people's lives. We're not getting 1 in 10. I think you and I hear from about 1 in 1,000 people that we have touched. What will happen is they will hear your program. They will digest it. You'll say blue. And in their mind, they're thinking red, but it goes through their lens, and now it comes out purple. And they go around telling people, purple, where did that come from? It came from that interaction between what they knew and what you taught them through the program, and now we've got a whole new message out there. Some of the people that are listening to your program are going to be your guests at one point. That's pretty exciting. Some of the people that are listening to your program are going to have life-changing impact on other people. Well, if we could start tracing this stuff back, it would come right back to your program, what you're willing to commit your time and resources to in putting this kind of a message out there. Everybody needs to understand that.
Yeah, thank you, Chuck, so much.
How fortunate you are to have this vehicle.
Oh, man. I mean, hey, I've often said it. I've learned a lot more than I signed up for. You know what I mean? That's the joy. That's the beauty of it all. You know,
That's the joy.
So,
yeah. That's
and,
the
you know,
joy.
You said something I want to share quick if I can, Chuck. And
sure.
You know, what you said about what people may not even, when you just said there about blue when I said red or something like that. You know, this happened to me a couple of times and I wasn't aware of it and I might have blew it the first time. A guy's come up to me already, this was years ago, and said, Todd, I remember like last summer and you said, and then he quotes what I said. And I listened to that and I said, there's no way. I was anti everything that I believe in. There was absolutely no way. And I wrecked it kind of because I wasn't really aware. I kind of got in the way of the message, you know. The next time I caught myself, and a friend of mine helped me with that. Now, this may or may not be the case, but he said, you know, maybe that's what they meant in the Bible by talking in tongues. You know, if a
there we go, there we
message,
go.
And I just happened to be there. They heard the message that they needed to hear. And it was just sound coming out of my mouth because there's no way I said that.
Listen, people ask me, why do you still chase airplanes in the middle of the night? Why are you still out doing this? I got this letter one time back in the ancient days when people used to write letters. You and I are old enough to remember that, of course.
Oh, yeah.
I got this letter. And the letter started out, you spoke to our company on a Saturday. And I wasn't going to go because Saturday is my day. But I decided my life was in such sorry shape that I would go to that meeting and never go home again. Now, I don't know what he meant, Todd, but that's what he wrote. He said, then you stood up and you said, he put it in quotation marks and underlined it twice. He said, it changed my life. He went on for a page and a half about what had changed in his life, his outlook, the results, everything that was going on. Now, what's interesting is I'd never heard that. There's no way I could have said that. But that's what he heard. Our job is not to dictate to people what they're going to do. Our job is to cause them to think. Thoughts always precede actions. Thoughts always precede actions. Our job, our role in life, is to give people something else to think about, something new to think about, a new perspective. And that's what Charlie Tremendous Jones was talking about, the people you meet, the books you read. It changes the way you think. And when we change the way we think, we change the way we act. I'm writing a new book now called Solving the Puzzle of You. And in the book, I explained that there are three of us. Each of us has three elements in this order, spiritual, mental, and physical. Spiritual is our belief system. It's everything that we believe. If I believe everybody's out to get my money, I'm going to act that way. I'm going to change the way I address people. So beliefs modify our thinking or drive our thinking, which is our mental self, spiritual, mental, and physical. So what we believe drives the way that we think, and thoughts always precede actions. So it goes back to our belief system. What do we believe about other people? What do we believe about life? I read the other day, someone said, well, our lives are nothing but a speck in eternity and they amount to nothing. I would hate to believe that. I mean, gee, why get out of bed in the morning? But if we believe that every encounter with every individual is an opportunity to teach and to learn, to teach and to learn, everybody's a teacher, everybody's a student, then how exciting every day must be. Every day we're in the classroom of life. Every day we're out there learning something and teaching things that we don't even know that we're teaching. What a job.
Chuck, it's been a real joy, man. I'm a firm believer in we live our message. We really are our message. And listening to you tonight, I believe you live your message as well.
Well, thank you, Todd. And back to you. You know, God bless the work that you're doing. It's all about putting thoughts out there people can grab hold of. If they've heard black all of their life and you say white, and all you can do is move them to gray, well, that's great. That's wonderful. Thank you for all that you're doing.
Oh, man, really, it's really my pleasure. Thank you so much. Have a great night.
Great. Thanks, you too.
There you have it, Mr. Chuck Reeves. What a guy, man. Really, a lot of wisdom there. The book is Journal of a Climber, and you can find it at chuckreeves.com. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Thanks, all our guests. We certainly couldn't do anything without them and our listeners. Get over to TremendousLifeRadio.com. You can see all the guests that are coming up. Our archives are there in the vault. You can listen to any of the shows throughout the years, any of the back archive shows. TremendousLifeRadio.com. You can take us with you everywhere you go. Get on over to iTunes and subscribe. Just search Tremendous Life Radio. Thanks again, everybody, for tuning in. Until next time, make it a great day.